again. All this was a matter of notoriety in the city, and everyone spoke of it, especially when it became known that Lucinda was missing from her father's house and from the city, for she was not to be found anywhere, to the distraction of her parents, who knew not what steps to take to recover her. What I learned revived my hopes, and I was better pleased not to have found Don Fernando than to find him married, for it seemed to me that the door was not yet entirely shut upon relief in my case, and I thought that perhaps heaven had put this impediment in the way of the second marriage to lead him to recognize his obligations under the former one, and reflect that, as a Christian, he was bound to consider his soul above all human objects. All this passed through my mind, and I strove to comfort myself without comfort, indulging in faint and distant hopes of cherishing that life that now I abhor. But while I was in the city, uncertain what to do, as I could not find Don Fernando, I heard notice given by the public crier, offering a great reward to anyone who should find me, and giving the particulars of my age and of the very dress I wore. And I heard it said that the lad who came with me had taken me away from my father's house, a thing that cut me to the heart, showing how low my good name had fallen, since it was not enough that I should lose it by my flight, but they must add with whom I had fled, and that one so much beneath me, and so unworthy of my consideration. The instant I heard the notice, I quitted the city with my servant, who now began to show signs of wavering in his fidelity to me, and the same night, for fear of discovery, we entered the most thickly wooded part of these mountains. But as is commonly said, one evil calls up another, and the end of one misfortune is apt to be the beginning of one still greater. So it proved in my case. For my worthy servant, until then so faithful and trusty, when he found me in this lonely spot, moved more by his own villainy than by my beauty, sought to take advantage of the opportunity which these solitudes seemed to present him, and with little shame and less fear of God and respect for me, began to make overtures to me. And finding that I replied to the effrontery of his proposals with justly severe language, he laid aside the entreaties which he had employed at first, and began to use violence. But just heaven, that seldom fails to watch over and aid good intentions, so aided mine that with my slight strength and with little exertion, I pushed him over a precipice, where I left him, whether dead or alive, I know not. And then, with greater speed than seemed possible in my terror and fatigue, I made my way into the mountains, without any other thought or purpose save that of hiding myself among them, and escaping my father and those dispatched in search of me by his orders. It is now I know not how many months since with this object I came here, where I met a herdsman who engaged me as his servant at a place in the heart of this Sierra, and all this time I have been serving him as a herd, striving to keep always afield to hide these locks, which have now unexpectedly betrayed me. But all my care and pains were unavailing, for my master made the discovery that I was not a man, and harboured the same base designs as my servant. And as fortune does not always supply a remedy in cases of difficulty, and I had no precipice or ravine at hand down which to fling the master and cure his passion as I had in the servant's case, I thought it a lesser evil to leave him, and again conceal myself among these crags, than make trial of my strength and argument with him. So, as I say, once more I went into hiding to seek for some place where I might with sighs and tears implore heaven to have pity on my misery, and grant me help and strength to escape from it, or let me die among the solitudes, leaving no trace of an unhappy being who, by no fault of hers, has furnished matter for talk and scandal at home and abroad. Chapter 29, which treats of the droll device and method adopted to extricate our love-stricken knight from the severe penance he had imposed upon himself. Such, sirs, is the true story of my sad adventures. Judge for yourselves now whether the sighs and lamentations you heard and the tears that flowed from my eyes had not sufficient cause, even if I had indulged in them more freely. And if you consider the nature of my misfortune, you will see that consolation is idle, as there is no possible remedy for it. All I ask of you is, what you may easily and reasonably do, to show me where I may pass my life unharassed by the fear and dread of discovery by those who are in search of me. For though the great love my parents bear me makes me feel sure of being kindly received by them, so great is my feeling of shame at the mere thought that I cannot present myself before them as they expect, that I had rather banish myself from their sight forever than look them in the face with the reflection that they beheld mine stripped of that purity they had a right to expect in me." With these words she became silent, and the colour that overspread her face showed plainly the pain and shame she was suffering at heart. In theirs the listeners felt as much pity as wonder at her misfortunes. But as the curate was just about to offer her some consolation and advice, Cardenio forestalled him, saying, "So then, Senora, you are the fair Dorothea, the only daughter of the rich Clenardo." Dorothea was astonished at hearing her father's name, and at the miserable appearance of him who mentioned it, for it has already been said how wretchedly clad Cardenio was. So she said to him, "And who may you be, brother, who seem to know my father's name so well? For so far, if I remember rightly, I have not mentioned it in the whole story of my misfortunes."
"I am that unhappy being, Senora," replied Cardenio, "whom, as you have said, Lucinda declared to be her husband. I am the unfortunate Cardenio, whom the wrongdoing of him who has brought you to your present condition has reduced to the state you see me in, bare, ragged, bereft of all human comfort, and what is worse, of reason, for I only possess it when heaven is pleased for some short space to restore it to me. I, Dorothea, am he who witnessed the wrong done by Don Fernando, and waited to hear the yes uttered by which Lucinda owned herself his betrothed. I am he who had not courage enough to see how her fainting fit ended, or what came of the paper that was found in her bosom, because my heart had not the fortitude to endure so many strokes of ill fortune at once. And so, losing patience, I quitted the house, and leaving a letter with my host, which I entreated him to place in Lucinda's hands, I betook myself to these solitudes, resolved to end here the life I hated, as if it were my mortal enemy. But fate would not rid me of it, contenting itself with robbing me of my reason, perhaps to preserve me for the good fortune I have had in meeting you. For if that which you have just told us be true, as I believe it to be, it may be that heaven has yet in store for both of us a happier termination to our misfortunes than we look for. Because seeing that Lucinda cannot marry Don Fernando, being mine, as she has herself so openly declared, and that Don Fernando cannot marry her as he is yours, we may reasonably hope that heaven will restore to us what is ours, as it is still in existence, and not yet alienated or destroyed. And as we have this consolation springing from no very visionary hope or wild fancy, I entreat you, Senora, to form new resolutions in your better mind, as I mean to do in mine, preparing yourself to look forward to happier fortunes. For I swear to you by the faith of a gentleman and a Christian not to desert you until I see you in possession of Don Fernando, and if I cannot by words induce him to recognize his obligation to you, in that case to avail myself of the right which my rank as gentleman gives me, and with just cause challenge him on account of the injury he has done you, not regarding my own wrongs, which I shall leave to heaven to avenge, while I on earth devote myself to yours."
Cardenio's words completed the astonishment of Dorothea, and not knowing how to return thanks for such an offer, she attempted to kiss his feet. But Cardenio would not permit it, and the curate replied for both, commending the sound reasoning of Cardenio, and, lastly, begged, advised, and urged them to come with him to his village, where they might furnish themselves with what they needed, and take measures to discover Don Fernando, or restore Dorothea to her parents, or do what seemed to them most advisable. Cardenio and Dorothea thanked him, and accepted the kind offer he made them. And the barber, who had been listening to all attentively and in silence, on his part some kindly words also, and with no less good will than the curate, offered his services in any way that might be of use to them. He also explained to them, in a few words, the object that had brought them there, and the strange nature of Don Quixote's madness, and how they were waiting for his squire, who had gone in search of him. Like the recollection of a dream, the quarrel he had had with Don Quixote came back to Cardenio's memory, and he described it to the others. But he was unable to say what the dispute was about. At this moment they heard a shout, and recognizing it as coming from Sancho Panza, who, not finding them where he had left them, was calling aloud to them, they went to meet him, and in answer to their inquiries about Don Quixote, he told them how he had found him stripped to his shirt, lank, yellow, half-dead with hunger, and sighing for his lady Dulcinea. And although he had told him that she commanded him to quit that place and come to El Toboso, where she was expecting him, he had answered that he was determined not to appear in the presence of her beauty until he had done deeds to make him worthy of her favour. And if this went on, Sancho said, he ran the risk of not becoming an emperor, as in duty bound, or even an archbishop, which was the least he could be, for which reason they ought to consider what was to be done to get him away from there. The curate, in reply, told him not to be uneasy, for they would fetch him away in spite of himself. He then told Cardenio and Dorothea what they had proposed to do to cure Don Quixote, or at any rate take him home. Upon which Dorothea said that she could play the distressed damsel better than the barber, especially as she had there the dress in which to do it to the life, and that they might trust to her acting the part in every particular requisite for carrying out their scheme, for she had read a great many books of chivalry, and knew exactly the style in which afflicted damsels begged boons of knights-errant.
"In that case," said the curate, "there is nothing more required than to set about it at once, for beyond a doubt fortune is declaring itself in our favour, since it has so unexpectedly begun to open a door for your relief, and smoothed the way for us to our object."
Dorothea then took out of her pillow-case a complete petticoat of some rich stuff, and a green mantle of some other fine material, and a necklace and other ornaments out of a little box, and with these in an instant she so arrayed herself that she looked like a great and rich lady. All this and more, she said, she had taken from home in case of need, but that until then she had had no occasion to make use of it. They were all highly delighted with her grace, air, and beauty, and declared Don Fernando to be a man of very little taste when he rejected such charms. But the one who admired her most was Sancho Panza, for it seemed to him, what indeed was true, that in all the days of his life he had never seen such a lovely creature, and he asked the curate with great eagerness who this beautiful lady was, and what she wanted in these out-of-the-way quarters.
"This fair lady, Brother Sancho," replied the curate, "is no less a personage than the heiress in the direct male line of the great kingdom of Micomicon, who has come in search of your master to beg a boon of him, which is that he redress a wrong or injury that a wicked giant has done her. And from the fame as a good knight which your master has acquired far and wide, this princess has come from Guinea to seek him."
"A lucky seeking and a lucky finding," said Sancho Panza,
"but this,
especially if my master has the good fortune to redress that injury, and right that wrong, and kill that son of a bitch of a giant your worship speaks of, as kill him he will if he meets him, unless, indeed, he happens to be a phantom, for my master has no power at all against phantoms. But one thing among others I would beg of you, Mr. Curate, which is that, to prevent my master taking a fancy to be an archbishop, for that is what I'm afraid of, your worship would recommend him to marry this princess at once, for in this way he will be disabled from taking archbishop's orders, and will easily come into his empire, and I, to the end of my desires. I have been thinking over the matter carefully, and by what I can make out, I find it will not do for me that my master should become an archbishop, because I am no good for the church, as I am married. And for me now, having as I have a wife and children, to set about obtaining dispensations to enable me to hold a place of profit under the church would be an endless work. So that, senor, it all turns on my master marrying this lady at once, for as yet I do not know her grace, so I cannot call her by her name."
"She is called the Princess Micomicona," said the curate, "for as her kingdom is Micomicon, it is clear that must be her name."
"There's no doubt of that," replied Sancho, "for I have known many to take their name and title from the place where they were born, and call themselves Pedro of Alcalá, Juan of Ubeda, and Diego of Valladolid. And it may be that over there in Guinea queens have the same way of taking the names of their kingdoms."
"So it may," said the curate. "And as for your master's marrying, I will do all in my power towards it."
With which Sancho was as much pleased as the curate was amazed at his simplicity, and at seeing what a hold the absurdities of his master had taken of his fancy, for he had evidently persuaded himself that he was going to be an emperor. By this time Dorothea had seated herself upon the curate's mule, and the barber had fitted the ox-tail beard to his face,
and they now told Sancho to conduct them to where Don Quixote was, warning him not to say that he knew either the curate or the barber, as his master's becoming an emperor entirely depended on his not recognizing them. Neither the curate nor Cardenio, however, thought fit to go with them. Cardenio, lest he should remind Don Quixote of the quarrel he had with him, and the curate, as there was no necessity for his presence just yet. So they allowed the others to go on before them, while they themselves followed slowly on foot. The curate did not forget to instruct Dorothea how to act, but she said they might make their minds easy, as everything would be done exactly as the books of chivalry required and described. They had gone about 3/4 of a league when they discovered Don Quixote in a wilderness of rocks, by this time clothed, but without his armour. And as soon as Dorothea saw him and was told by Sancho that that was Don Quixote, she whipped her palfrey, the well-bearded barber following her, and on coming up to him, her squire sprang from his mule and came forward to receive her in his arms, and she, dismounting with great ease of manner, advanced to kneel before the feet of Don Quixote. And though he strove to raise her up, she, without rising, addressed him in this fashion. "From this spot I will not rise, valiant and doughty knight, until your goodness and courtesy grant me a boon, which will redound to the honour and renown of your person, and render a service to the most disconsolate and afflicted damsel the sun has seen. And if the might of your strong arm corresponds to the repute of your immortal fame, you are bound to aid the helpless being who, led by the savour of your renowned name, hath come from far distant lands to seek your aid in her misfortunes."
"I will not answer a word, beauteous lady," replied Don Quixote, "nor will I listen to anything further concerning you, until you rise from the earth."
"I will not rise, senor," answered the afflicted damsel, "unless of your courtesy the boon I ask is first granted me."
"I grant and accord it," said Don Quixote, "provided, without detriment or prejudice to my king, my country, or her who holds the key of my heart and freedom, it may be complied with."
"It will not be to the detriment or prejudice of any of them, my worthy lord," said the afflicted damsel. And here Sancho Panza drew close to his master's ear, and said to him very softly, "Your worship may very safely grant the boon she asks. It's nothing at all, only to kill a big giant. And she who asks it is the exalted Princess Micomicona, queen of the great kingdom of Micomicon of Ethiopia."
"Let her be who she may," replied Don Quixote, "I will do what is my bounden duty, and what my conscience bids me, in conformity with what I have professed." And turning to the damsel, he said, "Let your great beauty rise, for I grant the boon which you would ask of me."
"Then what I ask," said the damsel, "is that your magnanimous person accompany me at once whither I will conduct you, and that you promise not to engage in any other adventure or quest until you have avenged me of a traitor who, against all human and divine law, has usurped my kingdom."
"I repeat that I grant it," replied Don Quixote. "And so, lady, you may from this day forth lay aside the melancholy that distresses you, and let your failing hopes gather new life and strength. For with the help of God and of my arm, you will soon see yourself restored to your kingdom, and seated upon the throne of your ancient and mighty realm, notwithstanding and despite of the felons who would gainsay it. And now, hands to the work, for in delay there is apt to be danger."
The distressed damsel strove with much pertinacity to kiss his hands, but Don Quixote, who was in all things a polished and courteous knight, would by no means allow it, but made her rise and embraced her with great courtesy and politeness, and ordered Sancho to look to Rocinante's girths, and to arm him without a moment's delay. Sancho took down the armour, which was hung up on a tree like a trophy, and having seen to the girths, armed his master in a trice, who, as soon as he found himself in his armour, exclaimed,
"Let us be gone in the name of God, to bring aid to this great lady."
The barber was all this time on his knees, at great pains to hide his laughter, and not let his beard fall, for had it fallen, maybe their fine scheme would have come to nothing. But now, seeing the boon granted, and the promptitude with which Don Quixote prepared to set out in compliance with it, he rose and took his lady's hand, and between them they placed her upon the mule. Don Quixote then mounted Rocinante, and the barber settled himself on his beast, Sancho being left to go on foot, which made him feel anew the loss of his Dapple, finding the want of him now. But he bore all with cheerfulness, being persuaded that his master had now fairly started, and was just on the point of becoming an emperor.
for he felt no doubt at all that he would marry this princess and be king of Micomicon at least. The only thing that troubled him was the reflection that this kingdom was in the land of the blacks, and that the people they would give him for vassals would be all black. But for this he soon found a remedy in his fancy, and said to himself, "What is it to me if my vassals are blacks? What more have I to do than make a cargo of them and carry them to Spain, where I can sell them and get ready money for them, and with it buy some title or some office in which to live at ease all the days of my life? I'm sharp enough to sell 3, 6, or 10,000 vassals in the time it takes to say it. By God, I will stir them up big and little, or as best I can, and let them be ever so black, I'll turn them into white or yellow. Come, come, what a fool I am." And so he jogged on, so occupied with his thoughts and easy in his mind, that he forgot all about the hardship of travelling on foot. Cardenio and the curate were watching all this from among some bushes, not knowing how to join company with the others, but the curate, who was very fertile in devices, soon hit upon a way of effecting their purpose, and with a pair of scissors he had in a case, he quickly cut off Cardenio's beard, and putting on him a grey jerkin of his own, he gave him a black cloak, leaving himself in his breeches and doublet, while Cardenio's appearance was so different from what it had been that he would not have known himself had he seen himself in a mirror. Having effected this, although the others had gone on ahead while they were disguising themselves, they easily came out on the high road before them, for the brambles and awkward places they encountered did not allow those on horseback to go as fast as those on foot. They then posted themselves on the level ground at the outlet of the Sierra, and as soon as Don Quixote and his companions emerged from it, the curate began to examine him very deliberately, as though he were striving to recognize him, and after having stared at him for some time, he hastened towards him with open arms, exclaiming, "A happy meeting with the mirror of chivalry, my worthy compatriot Don Quixote of La Mancha, the flower and cream of high breeding, the protection and relief of the distressed, the quintessence of knights-errant." And so saying, he clasped in his arms the knee of Don Quixote's left leg. He, astonished at the stranger's words and behaviour, looked at him attentively, and at length recognized him, very much surprised to see him there, and made great efforts to dismount. This, however, the curate would not allow, on which Don Quixote said, "Permit me, Señor Curate, for it is not fitting that I should be on horseback, and so reverend a person as your worship on foot." "On no account will I allow it," said the curate. "Your mightiness must remain on horseback, for it is on horseback you achieve the greatest deeds and adventures that have been beheld in our age. As for me, an unworthy priest, it will serve me well enough to mount on the haunches of one of the mules of these gentlefolk who accompany your worship, if they have no objection, and I will fancy I am mounted on the steed Pegasus, or on the zebra or charger that bore the famous Moor Muzaraque, who to this day lies enchanted in the great hill of Zulima, a little distance from the great Complutum." "Nor even that will I consent to, Señor Curate," answered Don Quixote, "and I know it will be the good pleasure of my lady the princess, out of love for me, to order her squire to give up the saddle of his mule to your worship, and he can sit behind if the beast will bear it."
"It will, I am sure," said the princess, "and I am sure, too, that I need not order my squire, for he is too courteous and considerate to allow a churchman to go on foot when he might be mounted."
"That he is," said the barber,
and at once alighting he offered his saddle to the curate, who accepted it without much entreaty. But unfortunately, as the barber was mounting behind, the mule, being, as it happened, a hired one, which is the same thing as saying ill-conditioned, lifted its hind hoofs and let fly a couple of kicks in the air, which would have made Master Nicholas wish his expedition in quest of Don Quixote at the devil, had they caught him on the breast or head. As it was, they so took him by surprise that he came to the ground, giving so little heed to his beard that it fell off, and all he could do when he found himself without it was to cover his face hastily with both his hands and moan that his teeth were knocked out. Don Quixote, when he saw all that bundle of beard detached, without jaws or blood, from the face of the fallen squire, exclaimed,
"By the living God, but this is a great miracle! It has knocked off and plucked away the beard from his face, as if it had been shaved off designedly."
The curate, seeing the danger of discovery that threatened his scheme, at once pounced upon the beard and hastened with it to where Master Nicholas lay, still uttering moans, and drawing his head to his breast, had it on in an instant, muttering over him some words which he said were a certain special charm for sticking on beards, as they would see. And as soon as he had it fixed, he left him, and the squire appeared well bearded and whole as before, whereat Don Quixote was beyond measure astonished, and begged the curate to teach him that charm when he had an opportunity, as he was persuaded its virtue must extend beyond the sticking on of beards, for it was clear that, where the beard had been stripped off, the flesh must have remained torn and lacerated, and when it could heal all that, it must be good for more than beards. "And so it is," said the curate, and he promised to teach it to him on the first opportunity. They then agreed that for the present the curate should mount, and that the three should ride by turns until they reached the inn, which might be about 6 leagues from where they were. Three then being mounted, that is to say, Don Quixote, the princess, and the curate, and three on foot, Cardenio, the barber, and Sancho Panza, Don Quixote said to the damsel, "Let your highness, lady, lead on whithersoever is most pleasing to you." But before she could answer, the curate said, "Towards what kingdom would your ladyship direct our course? Is it perchance towards that of Micomicon? It must be, or else I know little about kingdoms." She, being ready on all points, understood that she was to answer yes, so she said, "Yes, senor, my way lies towards that kingdom." "In that case," said the curate, "we must pass right through my village, and there your worship will take the road to Cartagena, where you will be able to embark, fortune favouring. And if the wind be fair and the sea smooth and tranquil, in somewhat less than 9 years you may come in sight of the great Lake Meona, Meotides, which is little more than 100 days' journey this side of your highness's kingdom." "Your worship is mistaken, senor," said she. "For it is not 2 years since I set out from it, and though I never had good weather, nevertheless, I am here to behold what I so longed for, and that is my lord Don Quixote of La Mancha, whose fame came to my ears as soon as I set foot in Spain, and impelled me to go in search of him, to commend myself to his courtesy, and entrust the justice of my cause to the might of his invincible arm."
"Enough, no more praise," said Don Quixote at this. "For I hate all flattery, and though this may not be so, still language of the kind is offensive to my chaste ears. I will only say, senora, that whether it has might or not, that which it may or may not have shall be devoted to your service even to death. And now, leaving this to its proper season, I would ask the curate to tell me what it is that has brought him into these parts, alone, unattended, and so lightly clad that I am filled with amazement."
"I will answer that briefly," replied the curate. "You must know, then, Señor Don Quixote, that Master Nicholas, our friend and barber, and I were going to Seville to receive some money that a relative of mine who went to the Indies many years ago had sent me, and not such a small sum, but that it was over 60,000 pieces of 8, full weight, which is something. And passing by this place yesterday, we were attacked by 4 footpads, who stripped us even to our beards, and them they stripped off so that the barber found it necessary to put on a false one, and even this young man here," pointing to Cardenio, "they completely transformed. But the best of it is, the story goes in the neighbourhood that those who attacked us belonged to a number of galley-slaves who, they say, were set free almost on the very same spot by a man of such valour that, in spite of the commissary and of the guards, he released the whole of them. And beyond all doubt he must have been out of his senses, or he must be as great a scoundrel as they, or some man without heart or conscience, to let the wolf loose among the sheep, the fox among the hens, the fly among the honey. He has defrauded justice, and opposed his king and lawful master, for he opposed his just commands. He has, I say, robbed the galleys of their feet, stirred up the holy brotherhood which for many years past has been quiet, and lastly, has done a deed by which his soul may be lost without any gain to his body."
Sancho had told the curate and the barber of the adventure of the galley-slaves, which, so much to his glory, his master had achieved, and hence the curate, in alluding to it, made the most of it to see what would be said or done by Don Quixote, who changed colour at every word, not daring to say that it was he who had been the liberator of those worthy people.
"These, then," said the curate, "were they who robbed us, and God in his mercy pardon him who would not let them go to the punishment they deserved."
Chapter 30, which treats of address displayed by the fair Dorothea, with other matters pleasant and amusing. The curate had hardly ceased speaking when Sancho said, "In faith, then, Señor Curate, he who did that deed was my master.
and it was not for want of my telling him beforehand and warning him to mind what he was about, and that it was a sin to set them at liberty, as they were all on the march there because they were special scoundrels.
"Blockhead!" said Don Quixote at this. "It is no business or concern of knights errant to inquire whether any persons in affliction, in chains, or oppressed, that they may meet on the high roads, go that way and suffer as they do because of their faults or because of their misfortunes. It only concerns them to aid them as persons in need of help, having regard to their sufferings and not to their rascalities. I encountered a chaplet or string of miserable and unfortunate people, and did for them what my sense of duty demands of me, and as for the rest, be that as it may. And whoever takes objection to it, saving the sacred dignity of the Señor Curate and his honoured person, I say he knows little about chivalry and lies like a whoreson and villain, and this I will give him to know to the fullest extent with my sword."
And so saying, he settled himself in his stirrups and pressed down his old helmet, for the barber's basin, which, according to him, was Mambrino's helmet, he carried hanging at the saddle-bow until he could repair the damage done to it by the galley-slaves. Dorothea, who was shrewd and sprightly, and by this time thoroughly understood Don Quixote's crazy turn, and that all except Sancho Panza were making game of him, not to be behind the rest, said to him, on observing his irritation, "Sir Knight, remember the boon you have promised me, and that, in accordance with it, you must not engage in any other adventure, be it ever so pressing. Calm yourself, for if the curate had known that the galley-slaves had been set free by that unconquered arm, he would have stopped his mouth thrice over, or even bitten his tongue three times, before he would have said a word that tended disrespect of your worship."
"That I swear heartily," said the curate, "and I would have even plucked off a moustache." "I will hold my peace, Señora," said Don Quixote, "and I will curb the natural anger that had arisen in my breast, and will proceed in peace and quietness until I have fulfilled my promise. But in return for this consideration, I entreat you to tell me, if you have no objection to do so, what is the nature of your trouble, and how many, who, and what are the persons of whom I am to require due satisfaction, and on whom I am to take vengeance on your behalf?"
"That I will do with all my heart," replied Dorothea, "if it will not be wearisome to you to hear of miseries and misfortunes."
"It will not be wearisome, Señora," said Don Quixote.
To which Dorothea replied, "Well, if that be so, give me your attention." As soon as she said this, Cardenio and the barber drew close to her side, eager to hear what sort of story the quick-witted Dorothea would invent for herself. And Sancho did the same, for he was as much taken in by her as his master. And she, having settled herself comfortably in the saddle, and with the help of coughing and other preliminaries taken time to think, began with great sprightliness of manner in this fashion. "First of all, I would have you know, sirs, that my name is—" And here she stopped for a moment, for she forgot the name the curate had given her. But he came to her relief, seeing what her difficulty was, and said,
"It is no wonder, Señora, that your highness should be confused and embarrassed in telling the tale of your misfortunes, for such afflictions often have the effect of depriving the sufferers of memory, so that they do not even remember their own names, as is the case now with your ladyship, who has forgotten that she is called the Princess Micomicona, lawful heiress of the great kingdom of Micomicon. And with this cue, your highness may now recall to your sorrowful recollection all you may wish to tell us."
"That is the truth," said the damsel, "but I think from this on I shall have no need of any prompting, and I shall bring my true story safe into port, and here it is. The king, my father, who was called Tinacrio the Sapient, was very learned in what they call magic arts, and became aware by his craft that my mother, who was called Queen Yaramilia, was to die before he did, and that soon after he too was to depart this life, and I was to be left an orphan without father or mother. But all this, he declared, did not so much grieve or distress him as his certain knowledge that a prodigious giant, the lord of a great island close to our kingdom, Pandafilando of the Scowl by name, for it is averred that, though his eyes are properly placed and straight, he always looks askew, as if he squinted, and this he does out of malignity, to strike fear and terror into those he looks at, that he knew, I say, that this giant, on becoming aware of my orphan condition, would overrun my kingdom with a mighty force and strip me of all, not leaving me even a small village to shelter me, but that I could avoid all this ruin and misfortune if I were willing to marry him,
However, as far as he could see, he never expected that I would consent to a marriage so unequal, and he said no more than the truth in this, for it has never entered my mind to marry that giant, or any other, let him be ever so great or enormous. My father said, too, that when he was dead, and I saw Pandophilando about to invade my kingdom, I was not to wait and attempt to defend myself, for that would be destructive to me, but that I should leave the kingdom entirely open to him if I wished to avoid the death and total destruction of my good and loyal vassals, for there would be no possibility of defending myself against the giant's devilish power, and that I should at once, with some of my followers, set out for Spain, where I should obtain relief in my distress, on finding a certain knight-errant, whose fame by that time would extend over the whole kingdom, and who would be called, if I remember rightly, Don Nazote or Don Quixote.
Don Quixote, he must have said, Signora, observed Sancho at this, otherwise called the Knight of the Rueful Countenance.
That is it, said Dorothea. He said, moreover, that he would be tall of stature and lank-featured, and that on his right side, under the left shoulder or thereabouts, he would have a grey mole with hairs like bristles.
On hearing this, Don Quixote said to his squire,
"Here, Sancho, my son, bear a hand and help me to strip, for I want to see if I am the knight that sage king foretold."
"What does your worship want to strip for?" said Dorothea.
"To see if I have that mole your father spoke of," answered Don Quixote.
"There is no occasion to strip," said Sancho, "for I know your worship has just such a mole in the middle of your backbone, which is the mark of a strong man."
"That is enough," said Dorothea, "for with friends we must not look too closely into trifles. And whether it be on the shoulder or on the backbone matters little. It is enough if there is a mole, be it where it may, for it is all the same flesh. No doubt my good father hit the truth in every particular, and I have made a lucky hit in commending myself to Don Quixote, for he is the one my father spoke of, as the features of his countenance correspond with those assigned to this knight by that wide fame he has acquired not only in Spain, but in all La Mancha, for I had scarcely landed at Osuna when I heard such accounts of his achievements that at once my heart told me he was the very one I had come in search of."
"But how did you land at Osuna, Señora?" asked Don Quixote,
"when it is not a seaport." But before Dorothea could reply, the curate anticipated her, saying,
"The princess meant to say that after she had landed at Malaga, the first place where she heard of your worship was Osuna."
"That is what I meant to say," said Dorothea.
"And that would be only natural," said the curate. "Will your majesty please proceed?"
"There is no more to add," said Dorothea, "save that in finding Don Quixote I have had such good fortune that I already reckon and regard myself queen and mistress of my entire dominions, since, of his courtesy and magnanimity, he has granted me the boon of accompanying me whithersoever I may conduct him, which will be only to bring him face to face with Pandophilando of the Scowl, that he may slay him and restore to me what has been unjustly usurped by him. For all this must come to pass satisfactorily, since my good father Tinacrio the Sapient foretold it, who likewise left it declared in writing, in Chaldee or Greek characters, for I cannot read them, that if this predicted knight, after having cut the giant's throat, should be disposed to marry me, I was to offer myself at once without demur as his lawful wife, and yield him possession of my kingdom, together with my person."
"What thinkest thou now, friend Sancho?" said Don Quixote at this. "Hearest thou that? Did I not tell thee so? See, we have already got a kingdom to govern and a queen to marry."
"On my oath it is so," said Sancho, "and foul fortune to him who won't marry after slitting Señor Pandophilando's windpipe. And then, how well favoured the queen is! I wish the fleas in my bed were that sort." And so saying, he cut a couple of capers in the air with every sign of extreme satisfaction, and then ran to seize the bridle of Dorothea's mule, and checking it, fell on his knees before her, begging her to give him her hand to kiss, in token of his acknowledgment of her as his queen and mistress. Which of the bystanders could have helped laughing to see the madness of the master and the simplicity of the servant? Dorothea therefore gave her hand, and promised to make him a great lord in her kingdom, when heaven should be so good as to permit her to recover and enjoy it.
for which Sancho returned thanks in words that set them all laughing again. "This, sirs," continued Dorothea, "is my story. It only remains to tell you that of all the attendants I took with me from my kingdom, I have none left except this well-bearded squire, for all were drowned in a great tempest we encountered when in sight of port, and he and I came to land on a couple of planks as if by a miracle. And indeed, the whole course of my life is a miracle and a mystery, as you may have observed. And if I have been over-minute in any respect, or not as precise as I ought, let it be accounted for by what the curate said at the beginning of my tale, that constant and excessive troubles deprive the sufferers of their memory."
"They shall not deprive me of mine, exalted and worthy princess," said Don Quixote. "However great and unexampled those which I shall endure in your service may be, and here I confirm anew the boon I have promised you, and I swear to go with you to the end of the world until I find myself in the presence of your fierce enemy, whose haughty head I trust by the aid of my arm to cut off with the edge of this, I will not say good sword, thanks to Gines de Pasamonte, who carried away mine." This he said between his teeth, and then continued, "And when it has been cut off, and you have been put in peaceful possession of your realm, it shall be left to your own decision to dispose of your person as may be most pleasing to you. For so long as my memory is occupied, my will enslaved, and my understanding enthralled by her, I say no more. It is impossible for me to contemplate marriage, even with a phoenix."
The last words of his master about not wanting to marry were so disagreeable to Sancho that, raising his voice, he exclaimed with great irritation,
"By my oath, Señor Don Quixote, you are not in your right senses, for how can your worship possibly object to marrying such an exalted princess as this? Do you think fortune will offer you behind every stone such a piece of luck as is offered you now? Is my lady Dulcinea fairer, perchance? Not she, nor half as fair, and I will even go so far as to say she does not come up to the shoe of this one here. A poor chance I have of getting that country I'm waiting for, if your worship goes looking for dainties in the bottom of the sea. In the devil's name, marry, marry, and take this kingdom that comes to hand without any trouble, and when you are king, make me a marquis or a governor of a province, and for the rest, let the devil take it all."
Don Quixote, when he heard such blasphemies uttered against his lady Dulcinea, could not endure it, and lifting his pike, without saying anything to Sancho or uttering a word, he gave him two such thwacks that he brought him to the ground, and had it not been that Dorothea cried out to him to spare him, he would have no doubt taken his life on the spot.
"Do you think," he said to him after a pause, "you scurvy clown, that you are to be always interfering with me, and that you are to be always offending, and I always pardoning? Don't fancy it, impious scoundrel, for that, beyond a doubt, thou art, since thou hast set thy tongue going against the peerless Dulcinea. Know you not, lout, vagabond, beggar, that were it not for the might that she infuses into my arm, I should not have strength enough to kill a flea? Say, scoffer with a viper's tongue, what think you has won this kingdom and cut off this giant's head and made you a marquis? For all this I count as already accomplished and decided, but the might of Dulcinea employing my arm as the instrument of her achievements. She fights in me and conquers in me, and I live and breathe in her and owe my life and being to her. Oh, horse and scoundrel! How ungrateful you are! You see yourself raised from the dust of the earth to be a titled lord, and the return you make for so great a benefit is to speak evil of her who has conferred it upon you."
Sancho was not so stunned but that he heard all his master said, and rising with some degree of nimbleness, he ran to place himself behind Dorothea's palfrey, and from that position he said to his master,
"Tell me, señor, if your worship is resolved not to marry this great princess, it is plain the kingdom will not be yours. And not being so, how can you bestow favours upon me? That is what I complain of. Let your worship at any rate marry this queen, now that we have got her here as if showered from heaven, and afterwards you may go back to my lady Dulcinea, for there must have been kings in the world who kept mistresses. As to beauty, I have nothing to do with it, and if the truth is to be told, I like them both, though I've never seen the Lady Dulcinea.
How? Never seen her, blasphemous traitor? Exclaimed Don Quixote. Hast thou not just now brought me a message from her?
I mean, said Sancho, that I did not see her so much at my leisure that I could take particular notice of her beauty or of her charms piecemeal. But, taken in the lump, I like her.
Now I forgive thee, said Don Quixote, and do thou forgive me the injury I have done thee, for our first impulses are not in our control.
That I see, replied Sancho, and with me the wish to speak is always the first impulse, and I cannot help saying once, at any rate, what I have on the tip of my tongue.
For all that, Sancho, said Don Quixote, take heed of what thou sayest, for the pitcher goes so often to the well, I need say no more to thee.
Well, well, said Sancho, God is in heaven and sees all tricks, and will judge who does most harm, I in not speaking right, or your worship in not doing it.
That is enough, said Dorothea.
Run, Sancho, and kiss your lord's hand, and beg his pardon, and henceforward be more circumspect with your praise and abuse, and say nothing in disparagement of that Lady Toboso, of whom I know nothing save that I am her servant. And put your trust in God, for you will not fail to obtain some dignity so as to live like a prince. Sancho advanced, hanging his head, and begged his master's hand, which Don Quixote with dignity presented to him, giving him his blessing as soon as he had kissed it. He then bade him go on ahead a little, as he had questions to ask him, and matters of great importance to discuss with him. Sancho obeyed, and when the two had gone some distance in advance, Don Quixote said to him,
"Since thy return, I have had no opportunity or time to ask thee many particulars touching thy mission and the answer thou hast brought back. And now that chance has granted us the time and opportunity, deny me not the happiness thou canst give me by such good news."
"Let your worship ask what you will," answered Sancho, "for I shall find a way out of all as I found a way in. But I implore you, senor, not to be so revengeful in future."
"Why dost thou say that, Sancho?" said Don Quixote.
"I say it," he returned, "because these blows just now were more because of the quarrel the devil stirred up between us both the other night, than for what I said against my Lady Dulcinea, whom I love and reverence as I would a relic, though there is nothing of that about her, merely as something belonging to your worship."
"Say no more on that subject for thy life, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "for it is displeasing to me. I have already pardoned thee for that, and thou knowest the common saying, for a fresh sin a fresh penance."
While this was going on, they saw, coming along the road they were following, a man mounted on an ass, who, when he came close, seemed to be a gypsy. But Sancho Panza, whose eyes and heart were there wherever he saw asses, no sooner beheld the man than he knew him to be Gines de Pasamonte. And by the thread of the gypsy he got at the ball, his ass, for it was, in fact, Dapple that carried Pasamonte, who, to escape recognition and to sell the ass, had disguised himself as a gypsy, being able to speak the gypsy language, and many more, as well as if they were his own. Sancho saw him and recognized him, and the instant he did so he shouted out to him,
"Ginesilio, you thief, give up my treasure, release my life, embarrass thyself not with my repose, quit my ass, leave my delight, be off, rip, get thee gone, thief, and give up what is not thine."
There was no necessity for so many words or objurgations, for at the first one Gines jumped down, and at a like racing speed made off and got clear of them all. Sancho hastened to his Dapple, and embracing him he said, "How hast thou fared, my blessing, Dapple of my eyes, my comrade?" all the while kissing him and caressing him as if he were a human being. The ass held his peace, and let himself be kissed and caressed by Sancho without answering a single word. They all came up and congratulated him on having found Dapple, Don Quixote especially, who told him that notwithstanding this he would not cancel the order for the 3 ass colts. For which Sancho thanked him. While the two had been going along conversing in this fashion, the curate observed to Dorothea that she had shown great cleverness as well in the story itself as in its conciseness, and the resemblance it bore to those of the books of chivalry. She said that she had many times amused herself reading them, but that she did not know the situation of the provinces or seaports, and so she had said at haphazard that she had landed at Osuna.
"'So I saw,' said the curate, "'and for that reason I made haste to say what I did, "'by which it was all set right.
"'But is it not a strange thing to see how readily "'this unhappy gentleman believes all these figments and lies, "'simply because they are in the style and manner "'of the absurdities of his books?'
"'So it is,' said Cardenio, "'and so uncommon and unexampled "'that were one to attempt to invent and concoct it in fiction, "'I doubt if there be any wit keen enough to imagine it.'
"'But another strange thing about it,' said the curate, "'is that, apart from the silly things which this worthy gentleman says "'in connection with his craze, "'when other subjects are dealt with, "'he can discuss them in a perfectly rational manner, "'showing that his mind is quite clear and composed, "'so that, provided his chivalry is not touched upon, "'no one would take him to be anything but a man of thoroughly sound understanding.'
While they were holding this conversation, Don Quixote continued his with Sancho, saying,
"'Friend Panza, let us forgive and forget as to our quarrels, and tell me now, dismissing anger and irritation, where, how, and when didst thou find Dulcinea? What was she doing? What didst thou say to her? What did she answer? How did she look when she was reading my letter? Who copied it out for thee? And everything in the matter that seems to thee worth knowing, asking, and learning, neither adding nor falsifying to give me pleasure, nor yet curtailing, lest you should deprive me of it.
"'Senor,' replied Sancho, "'if the truth is to be told, nobody copied out the letter for me, for I carried no letter at all.'
"'It is as thou sayest,' said Don Quixote, "'for the notebook in which I wrote it I found in my own possession 2 days after thy departure, which gave me very great vexation, as I knew not what thou wouldst do on finding thyself without any letter, and I made sure thou wouldst return from the place where thou didst first miss it.'
"'So I should have done,' said Sancho, "'if I had not got it by heart when your worship read it to me, "'so that I repeated it to a sacristan, "'who copied it out for me from hearing it, "'so exactly that he said in all the days of his life, "'though he had read many a letter of excommunication, "'he had never seen or read so pretty a letter as that.'
"'And hast thou got it still in thy memory, Sancho?' said Don Quixote.
"'No, senor,' replied Sancho. For as soon as I had repeated it, seeing there was no further use for it, I set about forgetting it, and if I recollect any of it, it is that about subterranean, I mean to say sovereign, lady, and the end, yours till death, the knight of the rueful countenance. And between these two I put into it more than 300 my souls and my lives and my eyes.
Chapter 31 Of the delectable discussion between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, his squire, together with other incidents.
"'All that is not unsatisfactory to me,' said Don Quixote. "'Go on. Thou didst reach her, and what was that queen of beauty doing? Surely thou didst find her stringing pearls, or embroidering some device in gold thread for this, her enslaved knight?'
"'I did not,' said Sancho. "'But I found her winnowing 2 bushels of wheat in the yard of her house.'
"'Then depend upon it,' said Don Quixote. "'The grains of that wheat were pearls when touched by her hands.
"'And didst thou look, friend? Was it white wheat or brown?'
"'It was neither, but red,' said Sancho. "'Then I promise thee,' said Don Quixote, "'that winnowed by her hands, beyond a doubt the bread it made, was of the whitest. "'But go on.' When thou gavest her my letter, did she kiss it? Did she place it on her head? Did she perform any ceremony befitting it, or what did she do?
When I went to give it to her, replied Sancho, she was hard at it, swaying from side to side with a lot of wheat she had in a sieve, and she said to me, lay the letter, friend, on top of that sack, for I cannot read it until I've done sifting all this.
Discreet lady, said Don Quixote, that was in order to read it at her leisure and enjoy it. "'Proceed, Sancho. While she was engaged in her occupation, what converse did she hold with thee? What did she ask about me, and what answer didst thou give? Make haste, tell me all, and let not an atom be left behind in the ink-bottle.'
"'She asked me nothing,' said Sancho. "'But I told her how your worship was left doing penance in her service, naked from the waist up, in among these mountains like a savage, sleeping on the ground, not eating bread off a tablecloth, nor combing your beard, weeping and cursing your fortune.'
"'In saying I cursed my fortune, thou saidst wrong,' said Don Quixote.
for rather do I bless it and shall bless it all the days of my life, for having made me worthy of aspiring to love so lofty a lady as Dulcinea del Toboso."
"And so lofty she is," said Sancho, "that she overtops me by more than a hand's breadth."
"What, Sancho?" said Don Quixote. "Didst thou measure with her?"
I measured her in this way," said Sancho. "Going to help her to put a sack of wheat on the back of an ass, we came so close together that I could see she stood more than a good palm over me."
"Well," said Don Quixote,
"and doth she not of a truth accompany and adorn this greatness with a thousand million charms of mind? But one thing thou wilt not deny, Sancho. When thou camest close to her, didst thou not perceive a Sabaean odour from some exotic shore, an aromatic fragrance, I know not what, delicious, that I cannot find a name for? I mean a redolence, an exhalation, as if thou wert in the shop of some dainty glover."
"All I can say is," said Sancho, "that I did perceive a little odour, something goaty. It must have been that she was all in a sweat with hard work."
"It could not be that," said Don Quixote, "but thou must have been suffering from a cold in the head, or must have smelt thyself. For I know well what would be the scent of that rose among thorns, that lily of the field, that dissolved amber."
"Maybe so," replied Sancho. "There often comes from myself that same odour which then seemed to me to come from her grace, the Lady Dulcinea. But that's no wonder, for one devil is like another."
"Well then," continued Don Quixote, "now she has done sifting the corn and sent it to the mill. What did she do when she read the letter?"
"As for the letter," said Sancho, "she did not read it, for she said she could neither read nor write. Instead of that, she tore it up into small pieces, saying that she did not want to let anyone read it, lest her secret should become known in the village, and that what I had told her by word of mouth about the love your worship bore her, and the extraordinary penance you were doing for her sake, was enough. And, to make an end of it, she told me to tell your worship that she kissed your hands, and that she had a greater desire to see you than to write to you, and that therefore she entreated and commanded you, on sight of this present, to come out of these thickets, and to have done with carrying on absurdities, and to set out at once for El Toboso, unless something else of greater importance should happen, for she had a great desire to see your worship. She laughed greatly when I told her how your worship was called the Knight of the Rueful Countenance. I asked her if that Biscayan the other day had been there, and she told me he had, and that he was an honest fellow. I asked her, too, about the galley slaves, but she said she hadn't seen any as yet."
"So far, all goes well," said Don Quixote. "But tell me, what jewel was it that she gave thee on taking thy leave, in return for thy tidings of me? For it is a usual and ancient custom with knights and ladies errant to give the squires, damsels, or dwarfs who bring tidings of their ladies to the knights, or of their knights to the ladies, some rich jewel as a guerdon for good news and acknowledgment of the message."
"That is very likely," said Sancho, "and a good custom it was, to my mind. But that must have been in days gone by. For now it would seem to be the custom only to give a piece of bread and cheese, because that was what my Lady Dulcinea gave me over the top of the yard wall when I took leave of her. And moreover, it was sheep's milk cheese."
"She is generous in the extreme," said Don Quixote. "And if she did not give thee a jewel of gold, no doubt it must have been because she had not one to hand there to give thee. No matter. A good gift will bide. I shall see her, and all shall be made right. But knowest thou what amazes me, Sancho? It seems to me thou must have gone and come through the air, for thou hast taken but little more than 3 days to go to El Toboso and return, though it is more than 30 leagues from here to there. From which I am inclined to think that the sage magician who is my friend, and watches over my interests, for of necessity there is and must be one, or else I should not be a right knight-errant, that this same, I say, must have helped thee to travel without thy knowledge. For some of these sages will catch up a knight-errant sleeping in his bed, and without his knowing how or in what way it happened, he wakes up the next day more than 1,000 leagues away from the place where he went to sleep. And if it were not for this, knights-errant would not be able to give aid to one another in peril, as they do at every turn. For a knight, maybe, is fighting in the mountains of Armenia with some dragon or fierce serpent or another knight, and gets the worst of the battle, and is at the point of death.
But when he least looks for it, there appears over against him on a cloud, or chariot of fire, another knight, a friend of his who just before had been in England, and who takes his part and delivers him from death. And at night he finds himself in his own quarters, supping very much to his satisfaction. And yet from one place to the other will have been 2 or 3,000 leagues.